I have a dream that all men are created equal.
G'day everyone. This is the additional content for episode 47 of Your Story. You can find the full episode over at yourstorypodcast.com or on iTunes. This is the entire 1.5 hour conversation I had with Cliff, where he goes into a lot more detail about the issues that we discuss on the show proper. As I said on the show, if you find this information interesting, please leave a comment over at yourstorypodcast.com. It's always good to get this information out. Here's Cliff. 20th November 2009. Hello, Cliff.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
I'm very well. Welcome to Your Story.
Thank you.
I'm a little bit interested in this product of yours. My local bakery, Soul Bread, has started producing a near gluten-free bread out of normal flour. And when I heard about this, I went, how are they doing this? Because it's still got gluten in it.
Right.
And I was introduced to what you're up to and the product that you're doing. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start with the product. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, that's, if I go back from the start, my family have got food intolerance and allergy, and we have Irish blood in our family on both sides. And so our children and our grandchildren have a gene which causes them to react badly to certain foods, such as foods based on wheat and foods based on milk and other things. And being a scientist, I thought I should try and solve the problem for our family. And so I started to do research on what was the problem in these foods. And the problem is that there are proteins in certain foods we eat, which our bodies can't break down. And if we have particular genes that recognize those problem parts of the proteins, we run the risk of having an intolerant reaction to them and stimulating our immune system to such a degree that it causes major health problems.
Right, so it is a immune response.
It's an immune response to food proteins. And you can have this gene all your life and not have it turned on. So you might know you've got a food intolerance and allergy, or you might be a male, and males are so insensitive that they never work out they've got a health problem. But eventually they will, because once the gene is turned on at some stage in your life by a vaccination or a virus or stress, or you think you're going to become a triathlete or something, your immune system is turned on and it recognises the protein, and the reaction is continuous because every day you eat this food and the immune system gets so sensitive that it produces proteins that start to harm your body. And what I went looking for was a natural food whose task given to it by nature was to produce an enzyme which specifically targeted that part of the protein that caused the problem. Now, as it turned out, a large number of plants need to have proteins, enzymes like we make, for their normal functioning to actually survive and prosper and to use their own energy source and so on. So we looked at all the crops grown in Queensland, worked out which one was very, very specific for the part of the protein that caused the problem. We didn't want a product which just broke down protein in general. We just wanted to do one job, like a pair of scissors that cut the part of the protein which was the problem. So we started looking at things like gluten in wheat, and were able to completely break down the proteins that have the problem in it, the gluten, the various gluten proteins.
So with gluten, it's a protein, so I imagine it's a fairly long...
big protein. It's got multiple numbers of these bad parts of the protein.
Has it really? Okay. So it's not just one specific...
No. It's got
multiple...
It's rich in this group.
Okay, what about casein that's found in...
Casein is also rich. Okay. All the caseins. Whether it comes from mother or goat or cow or whatever, they have the problem. So the problem can emerge when the baby is born, for example. If the mother's has passed on the activation of the gene in utero, then when the baby emerges, it reacts to the mother's milk and the baby has colic, and sicks up the milk, and it goes into projectile vomiting, and it becomes quite a challenge for the mother.
And for the baby just to get nutrition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, our grandchildren had these sort of problems.
Yes.
And being a scientist with a sort of a bent towards the medical side, I went through the John Curtin School of Medical Research, and I've worked all my life looking to use my research to help mankind. I decided that I should be able to fix this up, being an optimist. And we quickly found that the various gingers that are grown have enzymes at certain stages of their growth, which are able to specifically attack these parts of the proteins that are a problem. So we started to do in the laboratory experiments showing that we can break down gluten and casein and peanut allergens and soy allergens. And,
wow.
And then we asked ourselves the questions, where else in our life are these sort of proteins found? Everything which is a problem to our health in reality, which is not a physical problem, if it's a chemical problem in a sense, a problem to our health, then it's because we have proteins that can't be broken down within our body. And
are you saying all food allergies are because of proteins?
Absolutely. Let me quickly make a statement. Most of the problems we have with foods come from proteins. There are some polysaccharides which cause a problem. Things like salicylate, I don't believe salicylate's a problem. I think those foods that are high in salicylate are also high in a protein called prolactin, and that is one of the peanut allergens, actually. But it's present in strawberries and tomatoes, and you name it, it's present. And there is another protein which is in plants, which is encapsulating the oils in plants. See, plants, to survive over many, many billions of years, in a sense, they have evolved so that their energy source is protected from invasion by any predator. So they coat themselves, they coat the energy cells in a protein which no animal can digest. So if a plant's got a seed, that seed will have in it a protein which our body can't break down, encapsulating either the starch or the oil.
And that's to protect the plant?
Absolutely, and it likes the seed to go in a plant, go out the other end, because nothing can be digested.
Of course.
And so it's its means of protecting its regeneration. The problem is our body sees that as something that can't be broken down, and it sees it as a threat. Now, 70% of Australian population, it's not a problem to, they don't have a gene to recognise the threat. They've gone through natural selection over tens of thousands of years, well, at least 10,000 years, where the people who had the gene died off and the others survived. Mm. And so in Australia, 7% of the population don't have a problem. Over 30% have the gene. Most of those are Irish or Scottish or some Celtic race, Scandinavian or Aboriginal or Asian, South American, African. These sort of people still have the gene because the Irish refused to eat wheat. And it was only when they discovered beer that they started to eat or drink.
Barley.
Yeah. Well, one of the cereal crops.
Yes, yes.
They fed it to cattle but never ate it themselves. And the Aboriginals, for example, and all other native people knew that they should have eaten yams or something out of the ground, not those sort of crops. Western civilization, which I describe as wheat and alcohol, was based on the discovery of wheat and it moving westwards, because eastwards they'd found rice. And so as a staple food, it went westwards, and it took a long time to get to Ireland, and they didn't like it. So,
well, you just mentioned rice. What about the rice proteins? Are they...
Rice proteins are rather deficient in these groups. They have a few of them, but it's not really a challenge.
These groups that are an allergen.
The Asian people who eat rice, they've got a good diet.
What about corn?
Corn is an absolute extreme case of these groups, but it's so extreme that nothing can break it down. So it goes one end and out the other end and gives you no nutrition. It's very little nutrition you get from corn.
Even when it's ground up into a meal?
Even when it's ground up.
All right.
Because you're not grinding up the little capsules that contain the starch and the protein.
So, but corn has a nutritional value, doesn't it?
30%.
Seriously?
The other 70% goes in the other end. The 30% is the non-gluten type proteins.
Okay.
So most of it goes in your mouth and out the other end.
Right. And it has a lot of these allergens.
It is the most extreme one.
Okay.
But it's completely non-digestible, the protein.
Right.
Our stuff can destroy it quickly.
Yes. So do you have any impact on corn?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Corn, with your product?
Sorghum,
yeah.
Barley.
Oh.
And we use it on many plant materials. Like a lot of people have a reaction to onion. And so if you want to cook onion, you simply put it in our product and leave it for a little minute, then cook it, and you won't have a reaction to it. Or another one which is important to me is wine. Wine comes from a plant, and that plant, they actually use the seeds in the preparation and the skins. There are proteins in wine that you'll have a reaction to, which is not a good reaction, and it will be a harsh taste, and it will be a number of other factors, and you'll feel a bit of uncomfort and discomfort on your stomach. Well, you just put one drop of our stuff in, and that wine matures from being a harsh wine to an absolutely beautiful one. If it's got quality.
Yeah, sure. Wow. Okay, look, you've run ahead here. Now, what is this thing? You said that there are several types of gingers, and from these gingers you've come up with
We believe in keeping the whole food. We don't separate. We don't purify anything out of it. I mean, we have done that. But our aim is to use a food, not an extract, not a purified extract of the food. Because that way we can market it anywhere in the world as a food. And people can take it without us making any claim. And no one can say, but you can't have that. Because it's a food which is generally recognised as safe. It's been used for thousands of years. And so anyone can...
And you also don't have to get it certified as such.
No certification.
As some sort of additive medicine thing. Yeah, right. It's
and
just a food.
The pharmacopoeia says you can put gingers in any medicinal product. It is one of the few products in the world where the pharmacopoeia allows you to put into any medicine. And in fact, in the over-the-counter medicines, 42% of gingers in them for some purpose. There are over 200 bioactive compounds in ginger. We want to use all of them, plus our special one that the others don't have.
Okay, so what... Like, there's so much in this. how did you know ginger? How did you know to go to ginger to start with rather than bananas?
Well, we looked at bananas, because bananas is an interesting one too. But the protein, which is the hardest for us to digest, is in fact what gives us our backbone. In our backbone, we have collagen. Especially a special collagen, which is a triple helix, and it's made up of multiple groups which we're talking about. And so we said, well, if we can get a protein, an enzyme which can break down collagen efficiently, we can break down anything with these groups, because it's such a difficult one to break down. Collagen, thankfully, doesn't respond to our stuff at our body temperature or room temperature. The meat industry was interested in being able to tenderise there. They gave me a challenge about the same time as I was doing this other work to find a food which that you could put into meat so that when you cook the meat, and only when you cook the meat, you tenderise the meat. And so the challenge I took on was I would tenderise meat between 50 degrees and 67 degrees centigrade. 67, you want to turn it off so it doesn't over-tenderise, and at less than 50, it's not going to over-tenderise it while it's sitting on the bench. Collagen changes conformation at 50 degrees, and we're able then, our stuff is able to cut it up over 50, between 50 and 67, then be turned on.
Okay, so this will work to tenderise meat?
Any meat. It's used now commercially.
Right, so you put it in a warming cabinet, it basically tenderises, and then you put it on the barbie and cook it up.
It's much simpler than that. We actually put it into, we have it as a dry powder, we put it into oil, and you just rub the oil into the meat and cook it as normal. And it improves the palatability by a huge amount.
Just as it's rising in temperature before it gets very hot.
Absolutely.
Wow. So it's just a one action use.
One action use. And you don't have to wait around for an hour to marinate or anything.
Yeah.
If you use the oils that we use, it takes all the spices you want through the meat. I mean, the Centre for Meat Research in Australia is named after me. It's dear to my heart. And that's why I'm so large.
So this is for breaking down collagens.
Well, it's the same problem, part of the protein. The reason why we can't digest it ourselves efficiently, like the connective tissue in meat, you chew this tough meat, you can't digest it. It goes down and you get a lump in your stomach. We buy the cheapest meat. We even buy Coles cow that's walked from Darwin, you know, and where you can't get your teeth in normally. But we just put our tenderise on, it becomes as good as a $37 piece of steak.
And does that mean because the collagen's been broken down that it's actually then digestible?
Absolutely.
So you get better nutrition out
absolutely.
Of it, as well as the comfort.
And then you've got another advantage. Most cattle, most meat, before it became meat, while it was still alive, was eating cereal grains, and so the gluten proteins are incorporated into the fat of the meat. And so people often say, I have a reaction to meat. They don't. They have a reaction to gluten that's in the fat of the meat.
Which has come from feedlots.
Yeah, like yeah, especially fatty meat.
Yeah, less of an issue with grass-fed.
Absolutely less. But nowadays, most animals are, before they go to slaughter, are supplemented.
Right. That's right. They're fattened for 3 months or thereabouts.
And aren't they? So people who have gluten intolerance will often say to me, I don't eat red meat. And I say, how can you possibly not eat red meat? And they say, well, it gives me a pain in the stomach. I say, well, it's not the red meat, it's the gluten. So here, rub my stuff in and you won't have a problem.
Okay.
And so, but, you know, our stuff is used for abalone, for example. It's a bit of collagen.
If we, and abalone is as tough as boot leather.
Absolutely.
If it's
you hit it with a mallet
if it's not prepared perfectly, yes.
Yeah, the recommendation is you get a mallet and you hit it for half an hour and then cook it. Well, the commercial producers of abalone to send to Asia simply dunk an abalone in our stuff and then pouch it and cook it and send it. Works like a charm.
Let's backtrack again. How did you pick ginger? How come ginger?
Well, we looked at a lot of products, but if you think back through Chinese, I mean, Chinese have been using gingers for many, many years. And if you talk to the wise old Chinese people, they will tell you how to use ginger to tenderise meat. And because I've got a close connection to China, I just knew that ginger would be one of the best. But I looked at everything. I looked at, I mean, papaya, the pawpaw, has been used for tenderising meat. But papain, which comes out of pawpaw, that breaks all protein down. So you end up with mush. You can't control the tenderization of meat. You can't. You will break down many proteins in your body. I don't want to do that. I only want to break down the bad proteins at the site, which is bad. So things like pineapple or pawpaw or mango or kiwi fruit or all these others which have similar enzymes, they're not as specific. So the ginger is a very special group.
And you doing the science thing, you went through all of these and sort of poked around to see which was going to work best.
We've only been doing this for 40 years, so we spent a long time finding the best one.
It's like all good things. Success happens overnight after 40 years.
But then we found that we could solve my family's problems with gluten.
And how is the family now?
Right.
Everybody's fighting
for it. I mean, they live on it. I mean, everyone lives on it. Yeah. But it's more important. There are many diseases that have this problem. And the more serious the disease, the more of these groups are associated with it, so the better our stuff can work. So we have not had enough funds really to get the independent clinical trials to go out on the marketplace. So it's been word of mouth. People take our stuff as an aid to digestion to solve serious health problems. If you think of what comes from food intolerance, rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease from food intolerance. Schizophrenia is an autoimmune disease from food intolerance. Autism is an autoimmune disease from food intolerance. ADHD, many, many, many diseases. Chronic fatigue syndrome. Celiac disease is an autoimmune consequence from food intolerance. It is not the main disease. It is an autoimmune disease coming from food intolerance. And
autoimmune diseases are a whole range of issues.
Yeah, what it means
and is you think most of them, if not all of them, come from food intolerance?
It comes from a hypersensitive immune system. And by that I mean that the immune system is producing, putting out so many proteins to tell the B cells do something that these proteins that they're putting out, which we call cytokines, they're like little bad boys. They go looking to see what damage they can do. If you produce it in just the right amount, they'll go and tell a B cell to make antibodies and everything will be right. But if you're making too many, they go and do other things. You know, it's just a concentration. And so they go and interact with parts of your brain, and they interact with a whole range of your body. And these diseases come from specific cytokines causing the disease. Now, since they're bad proteins, they have our group in it. So our stuff does give them a cut and reduce them down to normal levels.
Okay, so you're actually impacting on
we're modulating
the stuff that's causing the actual the condition.
Dramatically,
yeah.
Quickly.
Okay, I originally thought that this product encapsulated the proteins, but it doesn't. It actually breaks the proteins down, makes them...
It, doesn't completely break the protein down. It only breaks down the part of the protein which is bad for you.
Okay, so let's take gluten in, as a case in point. So somebody's got celiacs, so they can't normally eat it. But with your product in a loaf of sole bread, that they can. And that's because they still get all the benefits of the protein because the bad bits have been dealt with, actually destroyed?
Yeah, the bad bits are actually destroyed. They're broken up.
Okay, so all the other bits of the gluten protein that are valuable, that are not harmful, are still digested.
That's right. I mean, what the cereal chemist told me when I said I'm going to break down the gluten protein, they say, well, you won't be able to make any bread or cakes or anything, you know, because it was the general belief that the structure of the gluten was essential for how you get the volume of bread or the volume of a cake. And this was what their belief was. I mean, I'm a scientist.
This is my belief.
Right, but I'm a scientist who's had a lot of experience. And so they believed me a little bit. And so I said, right, I'll challenge you. I'll show you that I can break it down. And then we'll go in the laboratory and we'll make bread and we'll make cakes and we'll do all these things. And then we'll analyse the gluten, show it's broken down. And then you tell me if I'm right or if you're right. So one of the big flour companies who make a lot of the bread and stuff gave me their laboratory and all the technicians, and we made bread and cakes and pikes and scones and you name it. The technicians measured objectively the quality of all the bread and all that. And then all the managers, a large number of managers, they came down for a blind taste test. They didn't know which is which. And every person for every product picked our stuff as superior to their stuff.
Wow.
So not only did it make it safer for them, it made it more palatable. And more importantly, it gave it more volume. So instead of having to use a certain amount of flour to make something a certain size, you can cut down the flour.
Which is great economics, isn't it?
So it has had a major impact on...
When is the protein impacted by this product? In the case of gluten, is it impacted during the rising process, during the mixing process, or during the baking process?
Well, it starts at room temperature, and so we'll do it from room temperature, but throughout the whole process of making bread, making the dough, it works.
Okay, so so it doesn't impact on the elasticity, the stretching, that whole ability to hold the bubbles?
No, it makes it better.
It actually makes that
better? The bakers, I've worked in with the bakers, and they always make the comment, they've never had such a good dough. In terms of the gaseous dough, it really makes a good dough.
So the actual stretching aspect of gluten is maintained?
It's no longer restricted. I mean, the gluten is like it just holds it tight.
See, that's been the problem with gluten-free bread, hasn't it? Because you pull that gluten out and it's got nothing to rise with.
Well, gluten-free bread needs our stuff anyway, because the proteins in it are also not good for you.
Well, that's right, because it's just gluten they've got rid of.
But whereas gluten-free bread is like a lump of lead, ours is light and airy and that's really palatable. Sole bread came to me. They're like artisan bread. They make special sourdough bread, not using baker's yeast, but microbes they get from the natural forests. And so they leaven their bread over a long period of time. Also, our stuff is put in over that long period of time. And so the leavening process uses our stuff. And then they start to cook it. And our stuff keeps on working. And it makes a sourdough which is not as harsh as the normal sourdough, so it's not a strong sourdough bread. People who have food intolerance can eat it, not have a reaction.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, yeah. What is this product now? Why can't I just go out and get a lump of ginger, chop it up and throw it in?
If you buy powdered ginger at the supermarket, the powdered ginger would have an activity we're talking about of somewhere between 0 and 8. I've never found a ginger anywhere in the world with a higher activity than that. Ours is about 40,000.
A bit of difference.
And our problem is you have to use such a small amount to do what you want to do that we have to design our product so people can measure the amount to put in. That's our challenge. And you don't want to put in too much because you don't want to change the flavour of the wine or the bread or the milk. We can get allergy-free milk. I mean, you can put in a lactase, you get rid of the lactase problem, which is certain people have, but more people have casein problems. So you can make allergy-free milk for people who are allergic to milk.
So if you've got a casein allergy, you just put some of this additive into a bottle of milk?
We put a half a teaspoon in 2 litres, shake it up, put it in the fridge, and people can have a casein intolerance.
And it's that simple?
Fast. It's not poo-poo dust, you know. It is science.
Yeah, no.
It's an enzyme which is designed to do that.
So, without giving away any secrets, what is it? How did you come? Did you just get a whole mound of ginger and pull an enzyme out of it,
or do you grow something in vats? Of course, I did do that, and I isolated the enzyme and studied it, and you know, I've cloned it. We've done all those sorts of things. My view is that if you're going to be putting this into food, or you're going to be feeding it to people, it's better to use the whole plant. I mean, God created this plant to do various things, and we want to make use of the whole plant. It's got over 200 useful compounds in it. And in nature, these enzymes can function by themselves, but I'll let you know a secret, they can function much better when all the components of the ginger are present. Their activity is much higher. Their ability to function, to do a job, is much greater if you retain the whole product. And so everyone being a scientist would immediately purify the active component. That's where they make a mistake.
Yeah, how come a big lump of ginger doesn't work? What have you done?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that.
No, okay.
I mean, the problem is that people think any plant, like a grape seed or something, any part of a plant is the same chemically. It's like they believe that, like a piece of ginger is a piece of ginger, so it is the same. But any plant changes its chemistry daily. As we used to say, we could tell when a farmer up the Sunshine Coast spat on his field because he changed the chemistry in that ginger. And it's to do with the microclimate and the amount of water and the amount of sun and all those things. And there's a tendency for industry to want to do things without understanding the complexities of nature. And they certainly don't have any love for what they're doing. And my belief is, in all my chemistry, that unless you have love for what you're doing and give it that love to what you're doing, you'll botch it every time. So our protection is the fact that other people don't share the love for what we're doing. We can get a product every time the same.
Right. Do you actually manufacture from ginger, I take it?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Where do you get the ginger from here?
Sunshine Coast.
Yeah. And do you have specific farmers growing it in certain conditions?
Well, we have to go and look at each year because each climate's different. Each year's climate, each season's different, and so we have to go and see whose ginger is good that year. So.
Oh, right. So you've got very strict criteria to what you need.
We monitor it and assay it out of the ground and before we harvest it.
Right. And then you buy that.
Then I buy the stack.
Right.
I can't just go to the market and buy ginger.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Okay. So it's incredibly specific.
Well, that's why we can do it and other people can't, basically.
Oh, more power to you, more power to you. This is alchemy.
Yeah, foo-foo dust. One of our problems is it's so powerful that people say, can't do all those things. And I say, no, we only do one thing. We prepare a pair of bent scissors where everyone else uses a pair of straight scissors. And why would you prepare a pair of bent scissors? Well, all these proteins are bent. And so we can go and cut the bent proteins, but the ones with straight scissors can't cut the bent proteins.
Right.
And actually, it is a bend in the protein structure that we're after. Which proteins have most of these things in their structures? Collagen is one, but prions in mad cow disease, which people don't know how to destroy that. Well, our stuff can destroy prions. I've done the work in laboratories with the different forms of prions. And for a virus to be a virus, to be bad for you, it has to coat itself in proteins that your body can't break down. If your body could break it down, it won't be able to damage you. So for a virus to invade your body and do its functions, it has to have on its surface a protein which is non-digestible by our digestive system. And so it has to have multiple groups that our stuff attacks. So we can cut the proteins off the surface of a virus or a bad bacterium. Some bacteria we can't because they're coated in polysaccharide and our stuff can't cut polysaccharide, but many of the bad bacteria, all the viruses, all cancer cells have on their surface proteins which are important for their functioning. If I was able to give them a haircut, that cancer cell will not die, but it can't do what it wants to do. It can't bind to one another to form a tumour. It can't cause damage to your body.
And then your body's got a chance to work on it.
It goes through normal programmed death, and the body lives on.
Does ginseng have some of these properties also?
All plants would have something akin to what I'm saying. all plants.
Because I know just a smattering of natural medicine. And I know ginger is a great tonic, you know, basically overall general health tonic. I also know ginseng is, in Chinese medicine, has got huge benefits. And I can't help but, I'm not saying directly, but the ancients have often spoken of these things with high regard, and it almost sounds like you're taking ancient wisdom and bringing it up to date with modern science.
Yeah, well, I am ancient actually myself, but I mean, ginger has over 200 small molecules which are good for you, and the Chinese and the Indians and various peoples knew of those powerful things which can help get rid of inflammation and do a lot of good things for you. We want to keep those in our product. Ginseng would have not quite, I don't think it has the 200 recognised powerful components, but it would have a large number as well. It would do you good for some purpose. It also would have an enzyme in it which would do some good things for you. But it would not be designed to do precisely what we wanted to do. It would do many things. I wanted something which was totally specific. So when I put it into my meat, I didn't want it to break down the meat muscle. I wanted only to break down the connective tissue.
So you actually went for a specific part of it that would do just that?
Just that. Now, we can't break down elastin, for example, in meat. Elastin is just in one cut of meat. It is an ultimate protein. It's got so many of these groups, and it's got another group which makes it like a spring. We can't get in there to cut it up. It's too tight. You know, it's elastic, but it's still too tight for us to get in and cut it. So elastin we can't cut, but collagen in its various forms we can cut. So we can make your skin beautiful. I've worked on the Barrier Reef for 16 years. I've got no skin cancer.
My hands
are soft. I use a cream on it.
Well, you might manufacture a cream with this?
Absolutely, because it just softens the collagen. Gets rid of any problems on your skin. It's a product which we've worked on for a long time. We've had as experimental animals our whole family. And that's been very important for us because we can experiment on ourselves and not on others. We have an extended family that have got Irish blood in them, so we've got a large number of experimental animals. And we know it's safe, so we're not putting people at risk. And we've been able to work out how to use it for different applications.
The company's called BioHawk.
Yes.
What's the name of the product?
Well, we've got different products. One's called Digest Easy, and that's the solution. Kept in the freezer at the pharmacies, but use it from the fridge, and the other's called Relief, both sold as an aid to digestion. We do not sell them to solve any disease. I mean, eventually when we do clinical trials, we will sell it for that purpose, but at the moment it's simply an aid to digestion of proteins, which are a problem for you.
Right.
But word of mouth tells people that you can use it for a whole range of things.
And you sell this product online?
We sell it online. We sell it through pharmacies, Maloof pharmacies.
And I've noticed that you've got quite a few agents all around Australia who sell it.
And we've got a clientele around the world because people who buy our stuff are told by a medical trained person that they've got a short time to live. They've got a very serious disease, and unfortunately, we've done all we can, and we've tried everything known to man, and we failed. And we've proved that all the medicines that we use don't work. Now you can go and die in peace. And at that stage, people say, well, there must be an alternative. People don't want to die. When the doctor says you've got 2 days to live, they say, well, I better act fast. So they talk to people, and people say, why don't you ring that person up and have a talk to him? So we get people who've been told they've got a set time to live. We don't get many people who have just found out they've got cancer. We don't get many of them because they believe implicitly in the medical profession, as I do. But the medical profession have proven that they can't solve these sort of problems. So the only people who've come to us at the start have been Aboriginal people, because the Aboriginal women don't believe in Western medicine, and they won't let a white man touch their breast, for example, with breast cancer, or do these things in general. And so through contacts, personal contacts, they come to us in the sense without having tried Western medicine. And so they take our stuff, and we're able to treat them from the start and quickly recover. So it's a different scenario. But most of the people, like we've got a group at the moment, really seriously ill people, and these are not young people. So they're really past their prime, the medical profession sees it as a, they're expendable. And one had acute myeloid leukemia, told 3 weeks ago they had 2 days to live.
2 days, that's not long.
Their blast cell population in their bone marrow was 98%, not many other cells left. They called the family together and said, bad luck. We've been trying to treat you for 2 years and we failed. And, you know, you're better prepared to die. And thankfully, someone told them, well, ring this person up. And he left hospital last week. His white cells are growing. His red cells are growing. He feels strong and well. And we believe that he'll completely recover from that. And things like pancreatic cancer, where the person said they've got 3 weeks to live, and they go back in 3 weeks to the doctor, and there's no sign of it, not a sign of it.
How does this make you feel?
Great. I love it. Yeah. Especially when they come and tell us. A lot of people, I mean, it depends on what sort of person they are. The Aboriginal, one Aboriginal lady rings me up every month and finds out, asks me how I am. Rather than saying, you know, the other way around, but she says, how are you? I worry about you. Do you have enough money to do what you, you know, she worries about me. And a number of patients will get cured and they'll communicate with you and come and give you a hug and a kiss and say thank you. Not many. A lot of people, they say, okay, he's fixed me up. I paid for the goods. I don't owe him anything. Away they go. That's fine. I'd love to learn from them, you know, how they reacted to us.
Yes.
About a third give me all the medical records. Most doctors don't want me to get them, but I get them. And I'm able then to go through and study how our staff reacted with them and learn something from them.
And they get follow-on checks while they're using your
Absolutely.
Product?
So you can I keep them under Medicare all the time. Right. And I tell them, I'm a scientist, not a Medicare.
Yes, yes.
You follow what the Medicare says. And they say to the doctors, I've been told I have to follow what you say. And some Medicares actually will say, wait a minute, what is he saying? So they'll actually listen a little bit, but not many. Not many. Most are worried about the legal consequences.
You got onto this because your family's got this heritage.
Mm.
And you started studying. You said 40 years.
Mm.
Is that when you first started?
40 years ago, 1967, the first time.
You started 40. Nibbling away at this problem of gnarling these proteins.
Yeah. I didn't take as long to find out what was the best product. But, I mean, I've been doing a lot of things in my life. It's, you know, I've run universities. I've had a very busy international scientific career. And this was a side issue. But it came a time when I decided to leave academia and commercialise what I've been doing. And so in 1996, we registered a company and started to produce the product. You see, it's not just for humans. Unless we sort of had money behind us to get it on the pharmaceutical list or registered by TGA, I'm never going to make money out of what I'm doing with the human, helping human people. You get a lot of emotional benefit, but you don't get monetary benefit. Our aim is to produce something which is not too costly, but it can help other animals like cattle and chickens and racehorses. Now we're talking business because these are large numbers and we can grow a chicken through the normal process and the person who produces the chicken makes an extra 90 cents per bird by using our stuff. And now it's worthwhile. The way we make money is like racehorses. All horses in training are fed too much of the wrong thing, and they all react badly to the food. And so if they have our stuff as a supplement, their gut's not hurting them, they're not getting so many toxins into their blood, and so the horse enjoys racing. Where if he doesn't have our stuff, that's painful for the horse to race. Our stuff's been used right around the world, from the top stables in the world, making racehorses enjoy doing what they're doing. Tested by the stewards as a normal food additive, not as an aid to performance, simply allowing them to digest their food. So it's a useful thing.
Have you got into bed with large corporations and companies?
I made the mistake of doing that at one stage, and a firm which was, I thought, would have appreciated the fact that we were removing from their food serious health problems. I won't identify the company, but I thought they invested in us for that purpose, but they actually invested in us, I think, to close us down and remove a threat to their business and try and completely destroy us, which they did, actually. Destroyed us financially, anyway.
Really?
To get back the IP, I had to, you know, I was asset stripped, as they say. I had people whose lives depended on me providing our product. So I had to start up again from nothing.
So what was their strategy? That it was basically you were a threat to their...
We are a threat because it's like the cigarette. They were making products, which they called health food products, which they knew for a certain percentage of the people in the population were causing serious health problems. And they were saying to people, our stuff is healthy for you, when they knew that 30% were getting very serious diseases. These people saw it as a threat because I was going out saying, don't eat that sort of food unless it's got our stuff in, because it will hurt you. And so their idea was to destroy me and the company.
And we're talking about wheat-based products, egg-based products, those sorts of products.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the same a bit with... I mean, our problem is, like the medical profession, we're a threat. Because if we can feed a food to someone and cure a serious problem, they say, but hang on a minute, what's my role in all this? Well, your role is to work with the patient, to analyse the patient, to diagnose the disease, and to use the best technology to cure the disease as possible. But they don't see that. Same with any company, we are a threat.
So you got the intellectual rights back,
yes.
And you had to fight tooth and nail to get that?
Cost me a lot of money.
Ruined you by the sounds of it.
Oh, I did ruin it, yeah. But anyway.
But you're back on top, but you've got this great spirit. You know, you've got spark in your eyes.
Well, we had to, in a sense. You have to have optimism, and you have to get pleasure out of what you're doing. And it keeps us healthy. I mean, I'm ancient, and we are healthy. Our family's healthy.
I'm going to ask you, how old are you?
I'm 70.
Okay.
And my skin is in good order.
You've got better skin than me.
Yeah. And we enjoy life. And all my family, otherwise would be sick people.
Mm. And constantly moderating their diet. They're a constant challenge.
They would have serious diseases. I mean, serious diseases. So, I mean, the people we deal with, if you get a family with, like, a child has got a problem and we treat it successfully, you have to understand that all those children have a problem. The parents, at least one of them has a problem, and their grandparents, well, at least two of them have a problem. Once you get one person and you can show you can benefit them, then you've got a family, and you've got a very extended family. There are certain people, say from Germany or somewhere, where they don't have the same sort of problems, but Asians have all got the problem. And where Asians sort of migrated, like into Greece or Turkey or that part of the world, although they went through natural selection to purify their genes a long time ago, they've been contaminated again.
Mm.
And so they're good customers.
Mm. And with all this international travel that's happening nowadays, more and more of this inbreeding is happening. So these problems are going to come back.
And wherever Western civilization went, they thought they were doing good. I'm not sure they totally thought they were doing good, but anyway, they gave them wheat and alcohol, the two things which were going to hurt them. And same with our Aboriginal people, we gave them wheat and alcohol. That scrambled their brains and caused them to get fat and to have all these diabetes and you name it. We gave them those diseases by giving them wheat and alcohol. Of course, uniformly they had the gene. And still have the gene. It's a serious problem. So if an Asian person comes to Australia and maintains their Asian food, they're okay. But if they eat Western food when they're here, they've got a problem. And you're able to tell it. And I've got a special dispensation from my wife that I can look at people's bodies. And if you want to look at a woman's body, you can tell straight away whether she's got a food intolerance, which is active. That means the genes turned on and she's eating Western food. You simply have to look at the lady's bottom and look at her breasts, and the bottom of breast will be fatter than the waist. I mean, that will be fat. If a woman's got a fat stomach, then she's probably got male tolerance, because males lay it down in the stomach. But a lady will lay it down on her backside, and no matter how much she exercises, as long as she keeps on eating that food, she'll have a fat backside.
So the classic pear shape they talk about
is
an example of this.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to Turkey, which it's an absolutely beautiful country, and the young women up to have their first child, the figures are absolutely beautiful. And then they have the first child, they become a balloon. And the reason is that they don't vaccinate their kids or anything like that, so they don't have their immune system turned on until they have their first serious stressful happening. And for them, having a baby is stressful. I mean, they're emotionally stressful. And so their immune system gets turned on. And so if you go there, you have a look and see the change. You stand in the street and watch women walk past you. I'll give you a dispensation. You watch the women walk past you, 30% of them will have fat backsides. And everyone says, oh, they're all overeating. No, they're not. They're eating the wrong food. Some are overeating and not exercising. Some, I mean, there's 70% of the people who don't have the gene. If they're fat, they're eating too much. But in the 30%, a high proportion of them can't help it. They're reacting to the food they're eating, and no one's told them they've got a problem with the food. The medical profession doesn't recognise it. They tell them, go home and forget about it. It's not a problem.
Yeah, well, eat everything in moderation, but there are some things that they should never go near.
And, you know, we have this food pyramid, and at the bottom of the pyramid, what we could eat most of it is cereal grains. Rubbish. It's the worst thing they could be eating. So, you know, there's a... Now we turn the kids on with vaccinations. When they're one, we give them a triple antigen, which is one. And if they got the gene, they turn on. And if they're not turned on then, we give them a cervical cancer vaccination to the girls. And now they're turned on. They haven't got cervical cancer. They don't have a reaction straight after. Well, within weeks, they're suffering from food intolerance. That's not recorded as a consequence of the...
And is that happening from the Gardasil shots?
Whoever comes in that door and talks to me, I ask them a question, what turned on your food intolerance? And they'll be very specific. At a particular time in their life, after that time, they had a problem. And it was after they had a virus or after they had a vaccination. Now, the kids
would,
of today...
Would normal stress be involved in that too?
Can be. Or they become a triathlete. Everyone wants to be absolutely fit. Well, your immune system is going to be absolutely turned on. Now, if you think of all the things they're talking about, why are all our kids obese? Why are all our young kids got diabetes? Why are all our kids now getting rheumatoid arthritis? Why are they getting all these diseases? We are vaccinating them with a vaccine which turns that on, and the medical profession is not recognising that that vaccine is going to cause them a health problem. You have to deal with it. I'm not saying don't be vaccinated. All my grandchildren have been vaccinated. I want you to understand. Because I'm not going to say don't get vaccinated. But immediately after vaccination, do something to solve the problem. And there are specialists who use our stuff to reverse the problem. They put our stuff under the baby's tongue. And in between 3 and 6 months, they can desensitise them. So having been turned on, they can be turned off when they're young.
And then they don't have to use the additive long term?
Until they're turned on again. And now we give them a Gardasil. They turn on again. It is a serious problem which is not recognised. And the problem is a bigger problem today because we are turning the kids on deliberately. There are not too many countries around the world where we give these sort of vaccines. And those countries have got the problems. I'm a scientist and they're my friends. And I keep saying, you are doing the wrong thing. Stop it. You are causing a health problem for 30% of the population. They think they're doing good for mankind. I'm telling you that you're hurting 30%. 70% need your stuff, but not the 30%. It's the protein which is the problem. And all their vaccines now are to turn on the immune system, not the T1 immune system, which is designed to fight disease like that. It's the T2 immune system, which is the food intolerance immune system. If they focused on turning on the T1 system, no problem, because the food intolerant factor doesn't react to T1, it's only the T2. So they're all now, it's easy for them. They simply cut off proteins, mix them up, put them in, inject it into you. Not all that easy, by the way, but the problem is that the people with food intolerance, their immune system is already hypersensitive, right? Now you give them a jab, a large jab, and their immune system goes crazy. It's already high, and they don't get the flu. They don't get Hendra virus. You look at the people who had been infected with Hendra virus.
Hendra virus was a virus that was caught from racehorses.
Racehorses from fox, flying foxes and so on.
Yes.
Each case, there was a vet who was very fit who died. The other people, and I've talked to the doctors who administered them, and I asked them, do you think these people had food intolerance? And they agreed with their food intolerance. They were able to fight it because their immune system is so sensitive that anything that looks like the protein in the food, which the virus does, zap, it was able to stop the T2 part. So their immune system didn't go crazy.
So their immune system wiped out the T2 part of the Hendra virus, but the T1 part of it still went through and nailed these things.
So they were not... They were able to fight it.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a very important thing. People with food intolerance do not get the flu or a common cold. Do not get it. That's the one advantage. They've got enormous other problems. But if you talk to someone who's, say, a celiac or got serious gluten intolerance, and they say, do you get the cold or flu? Never had it. But they're very sick. but they never had a cold or flu. Now, when they're going to give the swine flu vaccination, who do they give it to? They don't give it to the 70%. They give it to the ones who are compromised. The Aboriginal people, people who are obese, people who have diabetes. They're the ones they gave it to.
Yeah.
They're the ones that should not have been given it because that's an adverse reaction. They don't need it.
What about wholesale, give it to everybody, mass immunisation?
I'm completely against it. You only need it. The 70% might need it, but the 30% certainly don't need it. And yet they're giving it to the 30% first. And that's a mistake. I mean, I've tried my hardest to tell people that is the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, but it's because of this complex T1, T2 business, yeah, which a lot of people won't grasp.
And the 70%, they've got no immunity, right? They're down here somewhere, their immunity is down flat. They need to have it up to fight. Otherwise, they haven't got much protection. So you need to have all these vaccines for these 70%. And 30% is significant, though. What about the 30%? And the 30% does get lumped in with the 70%. And worse, they see that they're the ones with a chronic disease, so they want to do them first. They're the ones who don't need it. It's the 70% that need it. Get the fit blokes. People who are fit and don't have the gene, give it to them, they need it. But don't give it to the 30%. Certainly don't force it on anyone.
How are people going to know whether they're in the 30 or in the 70?
If they've got food intolerance, they'll know.
If the food intolerance hasn't been turned on yet.
Well, if it's not turned on, the virus will turn it on, and then they'll know it.
And the vaccine could turn it on too.
Oh, absolutely, it will turn on. I'm saying it will turn on.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they've got a problem.
So if they don't have the vaccine, they won't have the food intolerance turned on, so yeah, why so not avoid the vaccine?
Absolutely. But it is a serious problem. I mean, people, young children who have been using our product for a serious, like chronic fatigue and depression and all these things, they go to school and they get jabbed for hepatitis B. That's the last thing they needed. They get jabbed and they get worse. They get more depression and more chronic fatigue. And so you say, but why did you accept it? They said, well, you weren't given a choice, you were jabbed. Yeah. Like here, roll up your sleeve, bang, you've got it. So I see that as a problem. The health industry has to come to terms with the 30%, and it's an important 30%. It's all the Aboriginals, nearly all of them. It's all the Asian people who are eating Western food. It's the Irish people who I see as important, the other Celtic people, Scottish people, and so on. These people are being penalised by this craziness that we're...
This is your passion by the looks of it?
Well, it's something which disturbs me because, like, you know, there's one with cervical cancer. And they say, oh, we have to vaccinate girls because they've got a small chance of getting cervical cancer. But that's an easy one to solve. You simply have to get our cream on an applicator and stick it up into the cervix. Gone in a couple of days. Gone. The doctors report no sign of cervical cancer. But they're risking the 30% by giving a vaccination. Now they say, well, do boys next.
They are.
Why?
And it's not even for cervical cancer. It's for the virus. That's right.
Well,
doesn't always turn into cervical cancer anyway.
No.
It's just a precursor.
It can, spark different sorts of cancer.
Yeah.
Papillomavirus is an easy one because it is so rich in these groups I'm talking about. We can get rid of papillomavirus very quickly. Like, quickly. The worse the virus and the worse the cancer, the faster our stuff works. If something's barely a problem, our stuff takes a long time to get rid of it because it hasn't got many of these groups. So there's a direct relationship between how bad the problem is and how fast our stuff works. And if it's simply a very low level skin cancer, which is growing very, very slowly, our stuff will take a couple of months to get rid of it. But if it's a very bad skin cancer, which is growing very fast, bang, it's gone.
Wow.
And that's the difference. And if you look at the proteins and the different sorts of ones, you'll see what I'm talking about. The worse the virus, the more of these groups, and the faster our stuff can cut it up and do a job. So we think we can help mankind. We have a foundation where we want to help people in different countries who have sort of been rejected, that they're people with HIV and other diseases like leprosy or TB or something, and they're like a community of isolates. They're out isolated with no economic viability and no way to protect themselves, and they're just left to die. And if ever we get financially viable again, I want to set up places in those sort of areas where they can make their own products and administer to themselves, and so that they can make themselves healthy again and have an economic basis to do it. And that's one of our aims of BioHawk, is to be able to help areas where people can't help themselves. It's a humanitarian goal we have, to help people who can't help themselves.
You've mentioned a few times that it's a bit tough financially.
Yeah, we were really taken to the cleaners. Our family was just, you know, financially destroyed. And we're at a stage in our development, and people now, because we've been helping, people are now talking to us about investing in us, which is very useful for us. Because if we don't get it, we'll have to go. We just can't survive. So,
what, actually close the doors?
Well, yeah, basically, in the sense that, the people here are doing it for love, not for money. And but we've got people who we've helped and are prepared to raise money to put into us, and I'm hopeful that that'll happen. It's interesting that the wealthy people, the people who should say, come on, I'll help you because you've helped me, you've changed my life. No, they don't come and offer something. They don't say thank you and go off and do their thing. But the poor people worry about you, like that Aboriginal lady who's dear to my heart, reading about and worries about me. And I think that's beautiful that she does that.
Mm.
And but we'll survive. I mean, God is on our side and we're helping people, so I think we'll do okay. But up until now, it's been a struggle.
Yeah, and getting shafted by a corporation.
Well, I learned a lesson there, which I should have known, but I won't go into why I believe them, but I believe that they would treat us properly. But after we've gone through all those struggles, they had a plan in place well ahead of time, and they met their plan to the day. So they were very efficient after a while. And those sort of companies have got enough money to destroy anyone. And when you've got very little money, they can destroy you very quickly. And the big companies, they have to change things. And the people you're dealing with, when you talk about a company, you're talking about people. They're getting a very good salary. And they'll keep on getting a very good salary, whether their product is working or not, whether it's causing a problem to the health of people or not. They get a very good salary. Especially the managers of it, they're getting a very good salary.
And they often get a better salary if the company does better.
That's right.
Even if people get harmed.
That's right. And so they think, well, what is it in it for me, you know, like them personally, not what is in it for mankind. I don't think we'll get help from big companies. The first thing they'll do is, how can I pinch the technology? How can I, position him so I can get hold of the technology for nothing? They go through this sort of analysis rather than say, let's work with this bloke and we can do something together. I don't think big companies do that in Australia. There are people over in America who are driven by humanitarian thoughts. They give away a lot of money. They really are driven in a way which Australians are not. And they've said, why don't you come over here? We can grab the money and put it in. If you come over here, we can do it. I just really believe that, we like Australia. We've lived in many countries, by the way. As a scientist, I've held senior positions around the world. But Australia's our home and our family's here, and we like Australia. So we'll stay here.
If at the end of the day you just can't make it viable, will you sell to somebody in the US?
No. No, we will. No. We would. We've of course got a backup plan for that. We think we can get it, and not to a big company. We can, maybe there's a group of people who have got similar aims to ourselves we might do. But I've learnt that unless you are driving something yourself, unless you've got you're driven by something, they will destroy it. And big companies especially, they think they can do it better. They thought they can make our product. They didn't believe anything we said. They just didn't believe that you had to do it this way.
And the classic would be just to find the active ingredient and try and synthesise that. That would be the easy cop-out.
Yeah, but then they would never have... They would try that.
Yes, yes.
But it would never work.
But that is the classic thing to do. You know?
Absolutely.
You know, like aspirin, just make the component.
That's what they want to do.
Yeah. Stick with the organic, original way of doing
plant.
It. The plant.
Because it's a food. And I can put it into any product anywhere in the world. And no one can say you cannot do that.
No FDA regulations.
No toxicology. In FDA, there's a box. Dry ginger. A ticket. My product can go in. Or crude ginger extract. I've got a solution. I just tick it. I let it go in. And it can be used. As long as I don't make a claim that's going to cure cancer or do something like that, which I don't do.
Yeah, which is what's coming.
My product is an aid to digestion. We will do the proper clinical trials. We'll pick the cancers which the medical profession can't solve, like leukemia especially acute myeloid leukemia or pancreatic cancer or cervical cancer. Things where they can try with their hardest. We can do it in days. We can cure the problem in days. So we'll do the clinical trials. We'll get it registered in Australia and elsewhere. We will then have a worthwhile product to help mankind. Now through the pharmaceutical benefit schemes, and doctors are protected from their insurance. You know, a medico worries about the legal consequences of using some alternative medicine. Because while they're using a product which has gone to Therapeutic Goods Administration or FDA, their insurance is covered. But if someone dies when they're using an alternative medicine, they're not covered by the insurance. So the first question they always ask is this covered by my insurance? Now, if they took the time to ask the insurance company, as some specialists have done, the insurance company will say, what is it? Ginger. Oh, what's the problem with ginger? Of course you can use it. If you think it works, you'll use it. And it's okay by us. But most medicos simply say, it's not on the list of products. And most medicos, this person has got a glioblastoma of the brain. He is stage 5. Therefore, he's not going to live. Therefore, I do the following things. It does not say in there, use ginger. And so he says, well, if I use ginger, that's not in there, so I'm at legal risk. And that's a serious problem. Like, there's a case in Sydney, dear to my heart, that person had Hodgkin lymphoma. Boy, huge, 13 centimetres by 9.7 centimetres. Huge lump in his chest. Serious problem. And his parents believed in alternative medicine. And they contacted me and said, can they use it? I said, well, I sell it as an aid to digestion. I'm not a medico. If you want to use it, you use it. But I'm not telling you to use it. So they used it and the cancer disappeared. Now, the hospital medicos are ringing them up saying, your son should have had 12 doses of chemotherapy and 12 doses of radiotherapy. That's what's put down in the books if you have this disease. And you have refused to give it to them. Therefore, the Department of Children's Services will take you to court for not doing the right thing by your child. And they say, but hang on a minute. Here are all the PET scans. He hasn't got it anymore. They say, no. If you have Hodgkin lymphoma, you have to do the following. And we're telling you, you have to have the following. And if you don't do it, you're liable. Now, I just think that is so crazy.
The problem's fixed. So where's the case?
Yeah. Why would you do it? And now you say, what is the risk of having the chemotherapy? Oh, now that is very serious. He'll be sterile and he might have this and he might well die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, but he hasn't got the disease now. And they said, yes, but he did have it.
And it's not curable, so therefore he still technically got it.
Yeah. If you don't have these treatments, he's not curable. And it's evaporated. And so they're actually ringing him up and threatening them, the parents, with legal action. And I just think, hang on a minute. Why are you doing this? Why don't you say, isn't this great? This person has been cured of a very serious cancer, which you can see, right? The PET scans show you. Here's a lump which is active. Here's a lump no longer active. Here's a lump gone. And instead of saying, great, let's make use of this, they threaten legal action. And that I have trouble with. Or you get a cancer to disappear. I mean, seriously, disappear before their eyes when they've got beautiful pictures. Now, their worry is, I diagnosed this to be pancreatic cancer. And I told the person that they had a short time to live. And now the images we get shows no pancreatic cancer. And we open up and look and there's no pancreatic cancer. That person can take me to court for wrongful diagnosis. And now I'm now legally liable. And instead of saying, how did you do this? They call all the records in so there's no data to take them to court. And I mean, this goes on all the time. Patients go back to the doctor and they investigate, they look at how the cancer's going, and it's gone. The first comments are, now I want you to understand that I have firm clinical data to show that you have the cancer. Now you're not allowed to think that you can take me to court for wrongful diagnosis. I've got the data to show that I diagnosed correctly. They don't say, isn't it wonderful that your cancer is gone? How'd you do that? Now the patients are very scared of the medical practitioner. I said, why don't you tell them how it happened? They said, well, he wouldn't be happy if I told him I took this Tinder product and it went. And the doctor's not going to ask them because he doesn't want to know.
No, he doesn't want to know.
Yeah, he doesn't want to know. So I say to people, why don't you go and tell the doctor, this is what I did and it went. So some do, but most of them don't.
And the doctors can get around with a bit of spin, can't they? They can just say, okay, listen, we're going to go down the chemotherapy, radiotherapy path, but here's an alternative. And you should do some meditation while you're at it and get stress out of your life and do all these other things
and
as well.
Read about it.
Yeah.
But don't do a chemotherapy where they're going to kill you. Don't take on a chemotherapy treatment when the chance of your living is small. Now, unfortunately, I've had some experience in chemotherapy. Some of the treatments, the risk of you dying is high.
From the chemotherapy?
Absolutely. But they don't tell the patient, you have a 5% chance of surviving this chemotherapy. But I think I have to do it because your other chance is zero. And so they go ahead and the person dies. And we had a case, which was a very interesting case, of a person with pancreatic cancer who had recovered so quickly with our stuff, the doctor said, oh, now you recovered so well, I'll give you chemotherapy. Well, he died under the chemotherapy.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It was so well, they gave him chemotherapy and they hit him hard and his organs swelled up and he died. And I said, but hang on a minute, he was well. Why did you do it?
Because he had pancreatic cancer and you can't cure it any other way.
And so they hit him hard. They hit him hard or he died. And I just think, hang on a minute. It's time people start to take this serious and to actually diagnose the situation on that day. With breast cancer, a lady had breast cancer. She was going in to have a mastectomy. And I said, well, you've got 3 weeks, try it. And she was feeling really good. She went in the doctor and I said to her, get the doctor to do a study before he puts you under the knife. He wouldn't do that. Took her breasts off. And then he said, but you had no active cancer. How come you had no active? Having done it and taken out the lymph nodes and done that, he said, oh, but your cancer wasn't active. Why didn't he do that before?
You know, so he removed all this stuff, the breasts and lymph nodes, and nothing was active when he took them off.
And because he just didn't believe that could go. We're in a patient, a person's room who had a serious disease, and they'd written him off and were going to put him under palliative care. I was a part of the family. I wasn't a member of the family, but I was accepted as part of the family. First doctor comes in, a woman, a bit more intelligent than men, and she says, I can't understand it, but he's absolutely improved dramatically, and so I'm cutting down all the drugs he's on every day by 50%. So we'll get him off all the drugs within the next few days, and I think he's going to be okay. She was using her eyes and looking at the bloke who now had normal colour, because when you got cancer, you've got normal colour, was eating like a horse, was walking, was talking, where before he couldn't talk, he couldn't walk, he couldn't eat, he couldn't do anything. And she was observing this, and she used her eyes. She actually looked at the patient. She just said, well, I'm taking him off all these drugs. She went out, in comes another doctor. He's the pain doctor. He didn't look at the patient. He opened up his Bible and said, he has grade 4 such and such a cancer. It says that he cannot be cured from this. He's going to be put in palliative care and he will die within a certain time. And I have to give him all these pain drugs. And I have to do this. He has to be put into palliative care straight away. And you have to understand his bodily functions will collapse. He's going to die. And we're all sitting there saying, but hang on a minute. That doctor said to get rid of the drugs. And this doctor walks in without looking at the patient and says, according to the diagnosis, he's going to die and he's going to go through pain. No question is in pain. No question. No question is, how is it? There's the Bible. Bible says, this is incurable. This is what I do. I've got palliative care. And he stood up to go out and the relation said, I would like to have another CAT scan to see whether he's still got the cancer. And the doctor looked at him and said, why do you want to waste time doing that? He said, well, I think he's actually much better. And the doctor says, you can't cure this cancer. And we went to walk out the door and the boy said, raised his voice and said, I want a CAT scan. And he said, I'll pay for it. And the doctor said, oh, you don't have to pay for it, I'll get it done. I'll get it right. Now, they would not provide the CAT scan. Having got the CAT scan, I refused to give it to the people.
Refused to give it to the patient?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
And by law, it's his. They refused. You know why they refused?
Because there's no cancer.
That's right. Now they've got a legal challenge. Yeah. How come I'm treating him for this and telling him he's going to die and he hasn't got a cancer? So they refused to give the CAT scan.
Yeah.
I'm just troubled by that. I mean, as a non-medico, I'm troubled.
Cliff, you're a scientist. And a scientist, by definition, has to follow the rules of observable and provable techniques. A lot of people, and I'm talking particularly here about the medical industry, say that your product is not proved. It hasn't been through the regime.
Absolutely proof. Right.
Now, as a scientist, you're in conflict with the medical science.
Yeah, but what I can do...
with this. How do you reconcile that?
Well, what I ask for is the patient, the person to keep under the medical fraternity and to ask them for assays on a regular basis, much more regular than normal. And I want them. When you get a blood assay, there's a lot of this data. You know, it's boring data. Mm. They're all numbers. As a scientist, I actually look at all those numbers and I can follow how the patient's health is changing. The medico looks for the person giving him a clue by putting L or H or something on there. And so I actually analyse the progression every time I get one. How is this patient? Is the patient returning to health or not? If you were to ask the doctor what's happened to, the CRP or some other thing, and then you say, but it's come right down to normal. They say, oh, it's not important anyway. But if you were to ask the question before, it was high. They say, oh, well, this shows he's very sick. But when you show it's come back to normal, all of a sudden it's not important. Or like it's a marker for a cancer. And they look at it and they sort of say, oh, yeah. But in reality, it's come back to normal. That's what I base mine on. What has changed? Is there any evidence that that person is now healthy? If he's not healthy, your blood analysis or your marker analysis will tell you you're not healthy.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with this. This is a grown-up version of anecdotal evidence, isn't it?
No, it's scientific.
Well, yeah, sure, it's measured. Yeah. It's measured.
But get a CAT scan, your own eyes, the same as the doctor, or a PET scan or an MRI.
Okay, so the information that you've gathered, why it's proof to you, but why isn't it proof to the system?
Well, the reason is this, that they believe miracles happen. I believe miracles too, by the way. But they say, oh, it just happened that the cancer disappeared.
Yeah, that one's allowed,
and,
isn't it?
And therefore, I have to say, until I prove by independent, absolutely independent, formal clinical trials, I can't really make a claim. And that's what we're trying to raise money for. We will do independent clinical trials. Now, it's a bit hard for some of these things. Like people with pancreatic cancer, they say, I'll do a formal independent. If I don't treat them in a couple of days, they're dead. Like there's a big study of pancreatic cancer, and they have people on TV showing these people with pancreatic cancer. And then the next time they got a different group of people. I said, why do you have different people? They said, well, they all died. And I said, well, maybe if you put them on my stuff, they could keep on living.
Yeah, but you've got to have a control group. And
how can you have a control group?
Well, this is the difficulty, isn't it? A control group, by definition, in this case, would die.
There are diseases where the medical profession recognises they cannot treat, like acute myeloid lymphoma. For them to treat that, it's sort of 5 years hard work. And then waiting a couple of weeks is not going to really change it. Right? So that one, the chance of solving it is zero. So they're saying, right, we're prepared, we might be prepared, to try your stuff for a couple of weeks to see if
it fixes.
Or like cervical cancer. Cervical cancer, our stuff fixes it almost immediately. The ladies tell me within a day they can feel a difference. And so why don't you wait a day before you do something? I prefer to do something which is non-treatable. Give me a pancreatic cancer. You've got 1 day to 30 months to live. Give me someone where they know they can't fix it. And then say, well, just give me 3 weeks and see what happens. Or an acute myeloid lymphoma or something like that, where they know they can't fix it. Give me 3 weeks and see what happens. They surely can get ethical clearance for that. I mean, I haven't faced that challenge yet. I've talked to them about it. And things like papillomavirus, easy. I can do papillomavirus on warts. You know, I can, if you've got an active wart, big wart, which has got a papillomavirus, I can show by putting my stuff in, by tomorrow it's gone. Right. Now,
that's an easy test almost anybody can do at home.
Easy test. So you have to select things like skin cancers and warts and pancreatic cancer and these things, rather than attacking, say, breast cancer, where breast cancer is a very complicated disease. There's many causes of breast cancer, and the cancer is not going to evaporate. And so you'll just see it change and then become benign. Or like liver cancer. Liver cancer, the cancer doesn't disappear. It just becomes a bit of benign rock in your liver, and your liver lives happily. lung cancer disappears and you've got another problem. So you have to go through and work out which ones. Maybe brain tumour, the glioblastoma. They don't have much luck with that. Where else stuff can make it shrink? We have to get a medico who's got enough faith in science that he'll do something different with these patients where they know they cannot help.
Did you know that it was going to end up messing around with major health issues when you first started down this path 40 years ago?
I thought it would be easier to convince people. I mean, of course, I'm an optimist. I just thought when they saw the cancer disappear, they'd say, it's great. That doesn't happen. The people think it's great. The family think it's great. But the medical profession doesn't understand it. I have to have money, in reality, to go down. There are scientists in Australia who are medicos who hold senior positions in, say, cancer field. And there are many of them. I can sit down and persuade them, if I've got the money, for them to do a trial and for them to get clinical trial and for them to write up the paper, not me, and publish it. Like with bird flu. The world was worried about bird flu. We did studies in the laboratory and overseas in the top laboratory, and we were able to get rid of bird flu. Now, I have to have money then to go and do a clinical trial with animals and show that we can stop chickens being infected by it. Or with hendavirus, we have to show that the hamster won't get hendavirus. We have to have the money to do that. No one is going to do it for free, right? And no one will do it unless I twist their arm and push them to do it. But there are doctors in this world who like simple things where they're not under threat and they will happily do a clinical trial independently. That's what I have to get the money for. And we will select cancers, not because they're the ones we'd like to do, but the ones where they have no alternative. That's all we can do. And having got one and got it registered, they might think about it. If it's registered for one, they might think about it.
Well, you then it leapfrogs to the next one and slowly it builds, doesn't it, until it gets ahead of steam and it'll just run. You're not a young man.
No, I'm not.
What are you doing about the heritage of this product long term?
Well, all the people who work for me are part of our family, and some of those people are professionally trained and they've been trained. And we've got microbiologists and biochemists. And
so the family will care for this product when you're
gone? They'll continue. And they care for the intellectual property.
And they've learnt the lessons that you've been through?
They do what I tell them to do. where other people think they know best. Yep. Everyone knows best. I've learnt that. I mean, I probably am the same, by the way. But that's all right. It's my business. So I can...
Developer, inventor, you're allowed to.
Allowed to.
Yeah.
My business, I can fail or succeed or whatever. But my family know how to make it, and my family well trained. My daughter is trained in making confectionery in the top school of confectionery in the world, and so she can follow a recipe to make a food.
And I love that. You're talking about this amazing product, and now you're relating to confectionery.
But it's the same thing.
And that's what I love about it. Yeah. It is so incredibly, beautifully simple.
We have got our technology for making it. I mean, my idea is that unless you make it so simple that it's foolproof, they'll bug it. So our method of making our product is unbelievably simple, right?
I'd love to know, but I know you can't tell me.
But we disguise it in the sense that we have our magic in a packet. And so anyone can say it's make it, but I'll never be able to make it.
Yeah. It's like all good art.
We've got our foo-foo dust in a pack.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if we make it in any part of the world, they can make it. We'll teach them how to make it, but they have to buy off us our foo-foo dust that we put in.
Right, and, yes. The extra ingredient that nobody else knows about.
And we'll disguise it so no one knows what's in it.
Yeah, yeah.
They can try.
No one other person has the entire recipe.
That's our family.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Coca-Cola does the same thing, don't they?
And we've got a team of people all ready to join. So many people believe in us. They've been waiting for us to get money. They've not had money. We only deal with people who are poor. And they're saying, as soon as you get it, we'll come and join you and we'll help make it. We've got people who are very good at, large-scale productions and technical people and scientists who will say, well, I'll come and join you. And we'll do that together. But they'll never learn the secret of how we make it.
And fair enough, Tim. Fair enough. You've got to keep it in the family.
Our family, they all work for nothing. I don't earn anything.
So all the people in this building here?
I don't earn a cent. I don't earn a cent.
Do you manufacture here?
Yeah. We survive by the grace of God, basically. But we have rescued many, many people's lives.
Mm.
And we will get back to being big producers for the cattle industry, for the chicken industry, for the sheep industry, the goat industry, the horse industry, for cats and dogs.
Sounds like you're looking at that animal husbandry as the way.
It's where we make the money. Of course, you've got large numbers, and we can help them. They can make more money. You have to show them that you can make more money. Chicken growers make an extra 90 cents a bird. Big money. Cattle growers make more for their meat.
Yeah, and a lot of it's sad, isn't it? We actually put more value on the money that those guys can make than we will on the health of somebody.
Absolutely.
In the medical industry.
Racehorses. If I can feed my stuff to a racehorse on Wednesday and he wins, say, $30,000 at a race on Saturday.
That's a pretty good return, isn't it?
And the trainer says, hang on a minute, that cost me a very little bit of money and I'm making good money. I'll keep using this stuff.
Definitely.
So, I mean, our stuff was used before I got destroyed by the royal family in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Singapore Turf Club. Horses with our stuff won some of the most important races, most valuable races in the world, with very good prices, because until they start taking our stuff, they won much. And in Hong Kong Jockey Club, and a number of trainers in Australia. And it was used religiously by them, and they were happy with the performance of the horse. And the horse lived a happy life, and I used to be able to put my $5 each way on them and make a little bit of money to enjoy what happened.
That's your cash flow revenue.
That's right.
That's your revenue stream, mate.
You're able to do that.
And, no worries.
So, I mean, we a horse with our stuff won one of the richest races in the world at 99 to 1.
Yeah.
And the beauty is that the vets and the stewards have all declared it's not a performance enhancer. All it's doing, aiding in digestion of the food.
Yeah,
which
well,
it is,
and,
which
they,
it is.
And they use those already, don't they?
Yeah. Any.
Yeah.
Cut them all out. Cut rid of their food.
Just use this food.
So we get pleasure out of that. Cattle, I love. It's a work of art on four legs. And to be able to help the cattle, I enjoy. And I love cattle people. They're just the soul of the earth. They really have gone through a hard time, and just to talk to them gives me a lot of pleasure. And racehorses, I'm a chemist, for God's sake. I know something about dogs and about conformation of dogs. I've had a lot to do with dogs. But I've never really ridden a horse, and I've not been game enough to go near a horse. But I know a horse will respond to me, and the royal family of Dubai think I know all about horses, but in reality, all I'm doing is helping the horse recover from what they're feeding them. It's the same as with the humans. We're feeding them wheat, and I'm helping them recover from the feeding them wheat. They're feeding them too much feed and all the wrong stuff. And the horse somehow gets the feeling that I'm on their side. And so it's a pleasure to go there and meet all these beautiful horses. I mean, these are the top horses of the world and the top trainers of the world, and talk to them about the horses and see the horses perform. You know, you don't need money, you just need those sort of rewards, basically. As long as you can live, then you can enjoy it. That's what we've been doing. So.
Cliff, what a tremendous story.
Yeah, it's a bit different, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful. Just wonderful. And
I come from Newcastle. I went to Newcastle University College when I first started, and I decided I wanted to do something with chemistry when I was there. I went through the John Curtin School of Medical Research, which was my aim. I set myself the aim of going there, which was unbelievable experience for me. And then I set off to do magic around the world in chemistry. And if only school kids could understand.
Well, did you say magic?
It is magic, yeah.
It is magic, yeah. All science is magic.
Yeah. And so, you know, I just, and this is what I try to get through to school kids. Your life is in your hands. You can fix your health up, and you can set your goals, and you can achieve them. And I just, you know, I always had it as my goal that I would not go anywhere, I would go to the best place in the world. And I'd get to the best place in the world to do my science. And I would work with the top scientists in the world. I wouldn't work with an observer. I wouldn't just because I want to go and do a tour of England or something. And a simple boy from Newcastle can do that. But if you just follow the rest of them along, you go nowhere. And so I think kids have to understand that the future's in their hands. And if the food is causing their brain to be scrambled, depression, and they've got chronic fatigue and no one understands them, it's up to them to say, righto, parents, it's my life. I will control my life. I want you to start changing my diet. Give me this stuff and I'll be a different person. And so that's the sort of approach I take to kids.
I'll make sure that there's links on the site.
Yeah.
And make sure that we can drum up a little bit of business for you. For
yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. That's something that the people enjoy hearing about. That's something different.
It's a great yarn. It's a friggin' great yarn.
They can eat ginger.
And it's only ginger.
Yeah. Some people, I say, I don't like spice. Well, put it in milk. You won't taste the spice. Or put in honey.
It's only ginger.
Yeah, it's just ginger. But for God's sake, don't destroy it. Like everyone says, I'll put in manuka honey. I said, no, don't do that. Manuka honey is manuka honey because it's got peroxide in and it destroys their enzyme. So you have to tell people how to have it. But it's a simple thing. It's what we wanted, a simple thing, which is non-toxic. No one's got an allergy to ginger. Unless they've had some commercial ginger, which has had sulfur dioxide in it. But normal ginger is non-toxic. They can have it and they'll have a response to their health. And even the ones with the 70% people who don't have the gene, they will get some benefit from the ginger. And especially if they make their own bread, they'll have much nicer bread.
Mm. Oh, and more tender steaks.
And they can enjoy a cake, which is nice.
And you're also stripping more nutrition out of all these
foods. You're getting the nutrition.
Yes. Instead of it being passed through, you're actually
getting it. You have to eat less. You have to eat less. The same with cattle. I can put weight on cattle like a shot. With a human, they're going to put on weight, muscle weight. They're going to put on weight because we're now giving them really good nutrition, where before most of us going out the other end.
Yeah.
And so they have to understand to cut back on the amount of feed and exercise. Exercise and just get the right amount of feed and you'll have a really good life. A lot of people just want to keep on eating the same amount. They can't do that. They have to cut back.
Okay, so to wrap this up, what would you like to say to the people out there?
Well, I think they have to work out their own futures themselves. I mean, the medical profession is important because they can diagnose the problem and do things. I'm not knocking the medical profession. But it's in your life is in your hands. So you have to make the decisions of what's going to be good. Don't follow fads which have got no science basis. There's a lot of things out there, alternative medicines, which are rubbish. There's no science behind them. They'll do you harm. I'm serious, they'll do you harm. Look for the science behind it. If the science is sound and the person is not some charlatan telling you about foo-foo dust, then you might follow it a bit further and try it out. My worry is all these people who are well-intentioned, people who want to have alternative things, they listen to the latest crank and they tell me, what about this stuff? I said, for God's sake, don't have it. It's going to hurt you. But they have it. And why? Work out the science. You've got enough knowledge about something. How is it going to help you? Don't believe them. Why? How is it going to help you? And for God's sake, don't do things which are natural to your body. Only do things which are natural for your body. And having a food like ginger is pretty natural to your body, actually. So do that. Don't go and take all this other rubbish.
Cliff, thank you very much for telling us your story.
Yeah.
Absolute pleasure, mate.
Yeah, well, we'll be here for some years to go.
We'll send some people your way.
Yeah, right on.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye.
There are 8 million stories in the naked city. This has been one of them.